The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel, concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the February 11th, 2022 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing shows a classroom scene, looks like a high school classroom. The teacher and students are a little bit out of focus. In the foreground, on a side table, is a stack of books. Some of the titles are Mouse, M-A-U-S, Beloved, The Kite Runner, This Book is Gay, The Handmaid's Tale. The stack of books is circled in chains with a padlock on them, and enclosed in a clear plastic container, also has a padlock on it. The headline is Banning Books, the growing campaign to protect students and parents from feeling discomfort. And I believe that's our controversy of the week, but we'll start with the first main story. Breyer gives Biden a Supreme Court pick. What happened? President Biden said last week he would choose a successor for retiring Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer by month's end, and pledged to honor a campaign vow to name the first black woman nominee in the high court's 232-year history. The announcement by the 83-year-old Breyer that he would step down after the court's current term in June was greeted with relief by Democrats because it will enable Biden to name a successor with 51 votes while Democrats control the Senate. Breyer, the court's senior liberal jurist, faced mounting pressure to give Democrats the chance to confirm a successor before the November 2022 midterms, when Republicans may regain Senate control, and the power to block any nomination. Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer promised to move quickly toward a confirmation once Biden names his pick. Biden vowed to nominate someone of extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity, and that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. Conservative commentators and some Republican lawmakers assailed Biden for limiting the pool of potential nominees to black women. Senator Ted Cruz called it offensive, saying that black women make up only 6% of the population, while Senator Roger Wicker, Republican from Mississippi, said the nominee will be the beneficiary of affirmative racial discrimination. Three women emerged as front runners. Chief among them was Ketanji Brown Jackson, a 51-year-old Harvard Law graduate and former Breyer clerk who sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Close behind is Leandra Kruger, a 45-year-old Yale Law graduate and California Supreme Court justice who clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens. Third is J. Michelle Childs, a federal district court judge in South Carolina. Childs, 55, has the backing of Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina, a Biden ally whose endorsement was widely seen as key to Biden's game-changing 2020 primary win in the state. What the editorial said: Biden's pick is almost certain to be a progressive who treats the written Constitution with contempt, said National Review, and he's already done the nation a disservice by unwisely limiting the pool to black women. That eliminates scores of highly qualified progressive candidates solely because of their race or gender. That's not a great start in selecting someone sworn to provide equal justice under the law. Biden is absolutely right, said the Los Angeles Times. A black woman on the court is long overdue. Over more than two centuries, the High Court has had only two black justices and never more than three women justices at a time. A court that represents only a narrow slice of the American people cannot expect to forever retain the confidence of the nation it serves. And despite right-wing grumbling, there's a great wealth of eminently qualified black women jurists and legal scholars who'd be a credit to the Supreme Court. What the columnist said: Biden should focus on merit, not identity politics, said Heather McDonald in City Journal. Contrary to the nostrums of diversity advocates, a judge's job is not to tick a demographic box. It's to apply the law as accurately and transparently as possible. To limit the search by applying irrelevant identity criteria when only around 2% of the nation's lawyers are black females lowers the average caliber of the applicant pool. This complaint is laughable, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. For more than 175 years, only white men were deemed qualified for the court. Ronald Reagan promised to appoint a woman during his 1980 campaign and delivered Sandra Day O'Connor. Donald Trump touted Amy Coney Barrett's status as a working mother. And it would take heroic levels of delusion to believe race wasn't a factor when George H.W. Bush chose the unknown Clarence Thomas to replace Thurgood Marshall. The selection of a black woman is about justice, not just inclusion, said Ben Jealous in USA Today. Americans are increasingly aware of the civil and human rights violations that people of color routinely suffer at the hands of law enforcement. Our voting rights are under attack from new state laws designed to suppress the votes of black and brown citizens. There can be no better time to have a powerful black woman on the court as a voice for truth and accountability. Whoever Biden picks, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post, her votes won't make much difference. Replacing an octogenarian with a younger liberal has obvious value for Democrats, but it doesn't change the fact that conservatives will hold a 6-3 majority for the foreseeable future. Abortion rights are likely to be dramatically curtailed, gun rights will be expanded, and the line between church and state will be further blurred. Many years may pass before Biden's appointment will be able to write or even join a majority opinion on any fiercely contested issue. The controversy of the week: schools, the new campaign to ban books. When Dr. Seuss' publisher stopped printing one of his older books last year because of its racial stereotypes, Fox News and Republicans cried cancel culture, said Ryan Greenoble in HuffPost. But unashamed of their hypocrisy, conservatives in 30 states are now seeking to root out books from the classroom and school libraries that offend them. In what experts are calling a historic and concerted book banning effort, the likely inspiration was Republican Glenn Youngkin, whose successful campaign for Virginia's governorship featured a TV ad in which a white mother complained that her son had nightmares after his high school class read Toni Morrison's Beloved. The acclaimed novel includes extensive passages about slavery, rape, and murder. GOP activists, school boards, lawmakers, and governors across the nation quickly got in on the action, issuing orders and crafting legislation to protect kids from books that discuss racism, sexuality, feminism, and other, quote, dangerous topics. The ongoing frenzy of right-wing censorship is the largest since the 1920s campaign against Teaching Evolution, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Arizona lawmakers are considering a bill that would ban all depictions of homosexuality from public schools. Florida is considering legislation to ban any book with an LGBTQ character or theme. The school board in Tennessee's McMinn County even removed from its eighth grade curriculum Mouse, M-A-U-S, Art Spiegelman's Pulitzer-winning graphic novel about the Holocaust. The novel, the school board explained, includes a drawing of a naked dead woman in a concentration camp and offensive cuss words like bitch and goddamn. So, in an almost unbearable irony, the ban on Mouse means that 13-year-olds will no longer learn the history of a book-burning regime. Censorship of this kind is nuts, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter, but it's a predictable response to a left-wing power grab that turned classrooms into progressive indoctrination centers. Parents are objecting to their kids being taught that biological sex is an illusion, that America is inherently racist, and that whiteness is evil, and the other far-left tenets of critical race theory. Given the extremism of what many schools and teachers have been promoting, it is surprising that angry parents want to redress the ideological imbalance, or that politicians are obliging them. This is not a new fight, said Stephen Mim in Bloomberg. From Uncle Tom's Cabin to Darwin's Origin of Species to Huckleberry Finn and its frequent use of the N-word, the battle over which books kids read in school is an American tradition as old as the Mayflower. And both the left and right have sought to remove novels and texts for ideological reasons. I'm not reassured, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. We've had fights over certain books before, but not a heavily partisan national censorship campaign of this scope. In Texas, GOP State Representative Matt Krause is investigating a list of 850 books for their potential to cause discomfort. When I was 13, I was deeply disturbed by a novel, said Viet Thanh Nguyen in the New York Times. It depicted brutality, slaughter, rape, and racism by American GIs in Vietnam. But rather than demand that the book be censored, I was inspired to become a writer and depict the war from a Vietnamese perspective. It's the potential of books to be dangerous to our preconceptions, our complacency, our circumscribed empathy that makes them so vital. A society that starts banning books to avoid discomfort is heading to the wrong destination. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Josh Wardle, a Brooklyn software engineer who sold his wildly popular online word game, Wordle, to the New York Times for more than $1 million. I'd be lying if I said this hasn't been a little overwhelming, said Wardle, who created the game in October. It was a good week for the Washington football team, which dropped Redskins nearly 2 years ago over complaints it was racially insensitive, finally announced its new name, the Washington Commanders. And it was a good week for arts and crafts with the report that many of the White House documents obtained by the House committee investigating January 6 had been torn up by former President Trump and taped back together. Trump reportedly had a habit of ripping up internal documents in defiance of the Presidential Records Act. But it was a bad week for Whoopi Goldberg, who was suspended from ABC's The View for 2 weeks after the comedian said the Holocaust was not about race, explaining that Jews and Nazis were two white groups of people fighting each other. She later apologized. It was a bad week for Tonga, the South Pacific archipelago nation, which had its first COVID outbreak, with at least 5 people infected. Tonga was hit hard by a tsunami after recent volcanic eruption, and there were fears that foreign rescue workers would bring the coronavirus. And it was a bad week for New England, which failed to receive even a mention in the retirement announcement of quarterback Tom Brady, who played 20 of his 22 seasons for the New England Patriots. Brady did thank the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, calling Tampa such a fun place to live. And a short and other news piece on this page. Pfizer seeks okay for young kids' shots. Pfizer asked the Food and Drug Administration this week to authorize a two-dose regimen of its COVID-19 vaccine for children between 6 months and 5 years old. In clinical trials, the two-dose regime, using a tenth of the dose given to adults, provided a modest immune response in kids ages 2 to 4. Those children were infected at a rate 57% lower than kids in a placebo group. Although with few overall infections, the margin of error was wide. Pfizer is applying for the authorization at the FDA's urging as it tests a three-dose regimen. The company says three shots will likely be needed. About one-third of parents of kids under 5 say they would get their children's shots as soon as they're available. The briefing this week is a tarnished Olympics. Beijing's Winter Olympics begin this week under the shadow of COVID and China's flagrant abuses of human rights. How is Beijing preparing? The 2022 Winter Games will take place in a closed-loop system, or bubble, to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. A similar but more stringent version of the protocols utilized by last summer's Tokyo Olympics. Thousands of athletes, coaches, Olympic staff members, and journalists will be confined to an enclosed network of competition sites and hotels for the duration of the games. Everyone must be vaccinated or go through 3 prior weeks of isolation, and athletes will be tested daily. China has operated under an extreme COVID zero policy since the first cases were detected in Wuhan, quarantining tens of thousands of people and testing millions in response to a single case. Thus far, it's been successful in limiting outbreaks. China has reported roughly 4,600 deaths compared with nearly 900,000 in the U.S. But the Omicron variant has caused small outbreaks in Beijing and presents a new challenge. Olympic events will be held in Beijing and the cities of Yongqing and Zhangjiakou, northwest of the capital. Who are the star U.S. athletes? The U.S. is sending 223 athletes to the Games. Alpine skiing superstar Michaela Schifrin will look to add to her 2 previous gold medals and cement her status as a legend of the sport. Chloe Kim, who at 17 won gold in the halfpipe at the 2018 Pyeongchang Games, will return and is favored to repeat as champion. Snowboarders Lindsay Jacobellis and Sean White will become 5-time Olympians when they compete in Beijing, as will curling legend John Schuster and Katie Uhlander in skeleton. The Games will see the debut of 7 new events, including the Monobob, a solo women's bobsled competition. The 3-time bobsled medalist Elena Myers-Taylor will be a top contender. Beijing is 13 hours ahead of U.S. Eastern Time, so American viewers will see the opening ceremony and other live events with their morning coffee. Why was Beijing chosen? China was originally one of many contenders to host the 2022 Games, but Poland, Ukraine, and Sweden dropped out because of domestic opposition. Norway's bid collapsed over public outrage at the International Olympic Committee's demand for luxury treatment, such as special lanes on all roads for IOC members. China and Kazakhstan wound up as the only 2 bidders left. The IOC selection process now has a built-in bias for autocracies willing to pamper IOC members and build expensive venues without inconveniences such as democratic approval. China displaced 1.5 million people when Beijing hosted the 2008 Summer Olympics, and the 2022 announcement spurred a rush for developers to snap up properties in humble mountain towns, forcing longtime residents to move. Beijing and its environs receive little natural snowfall, so organizers have had to make artificial snow for outdoor skiing events. China's brutal persecution of the Muslim Uyghur minority and dismal human rights record has led to widespread comparisons between these games and the 1936 Berlin Olympics and 1980 Moscow Olympics, both of which sparked global controversy and boycotts. Will there be any boycotts? The U.S., U.K., Australia, and several other countries have announced diplomatic boycotts, meaning they will not send government officials but will let their athletes participate. "We will not contribute to the fanfare of the games," White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said. No country has announced a boycott of the athletic competitions. Olympic corporate sponsors such as Procter & Gamble, Intel, and Airbnb have chosen to do low-key ads focusing on U.S. athletes rather than withdraw, perhaps out of fear of angering Beijing and being denied access to billions of Chinese consumers. Adidas, Nike, H&M, and other fashion brands faced boycotts in China last year after they expressed concerns over sourcing cotton from forced labor in Xinjiang, where the government has put millions of Uyghurs into re-education camps. The companies are no longer expressing that concern. China is just so big, both as a market and a manufacturing juggernaut, that companies feel they can't afford to get in the crosshairs of the government, said Michael Posner, a former State Department official. What happens if athletes protest? Nobody knows. IOC spokesman Mark Adams said athletes could express personal views during interviews and on social media, but did not address how the Chinese government might respond. "I think we have to wait for concrete examples," Adams said. China's Olympic Organizing Committee has warned that foreign athletes whose speech violates Chinese laws and regulations at the games may face punishment, and has stated that the politicization of sports is opposed by the Olympic Charter. The IOC relaxed its rules on athletes' protest at the Tokyo Games, but it maintained restrictions on expression within Olympic venues and during competition. If athletes do protest, however, Chinese 1.4 billion people will probably not know it. TV broadcasts would not show any anti-government messages, and the Cyberspace Administration of China has announced a month-long internet purification campaign to cleanse the internet of illegal content and create a healthy, happy, and peaceful online environment. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Omicron is not the last variant. The coronavirus will surprise us again, said Sarah Zhang. In the 2 years since SARS-CoV-2 surfaced, the virus has stunned scientists with its ability to mutate, making evolutionary leaps like nothing we've seen before. The Omicron variant contains more than 50 mutations from previous strains. Its spike proteins alone hold more than 30. For comparison, the seasonal flu averages just one or two changes a year in its key protein. With 30,000 letters in the coronavirus genome, the number of possible mutation combinations is mind-bogglingly huge. Future strains could become more virulent, or more easily transmitted, or both. They will definitely alight upon new ways to escape antibodies we built up, although it's extremely unlikely our hard-won immunity will be reset to zero. With Omicron, we got lucky, says evolutionary biologist Sergey Pond, noting that the mutations that enable it to evade both natural immunity and vaccine protection also make it a little less virulent. But it is not inevitable that future variants will cause milder illness. The virus will never run out of new strategies, and the next successful variant may be very different from Omicron. Exactly how is impossible to predict. a coming constitutional crisis. If Donald Trump does run for president in 2024, said Bruce Ackerman and Gerald Maglioka, it will provoke a genuine constitutional crisis that will make January 2021 seem tame. The disqualification clause of the 14th Amendment expressly bars any person from holding office if he is engaged in insurrection. Democrats are already exploring using this clause to bar Trump from running again. Under our election laws, every state would have to decide whether to bar Trump from being on the ballot, and inevitably, more liberal states would disqualify Trump, while conservative states would insist Trump did not engage in an insurrection. Trump is likely to promote a stand-in candidate in the blue states, but with three candidates in the race, none may win the necessary 270 electoral votes. Under the 12th Amendment, the House would then pick the president. But if a majority of state delegations choose Trump, as is likely, Democrats will challenge the legality of his presidency in the House and in the courts. Months may go by with no clear president amid massive, violent street demonstrations. The Supreme Court and the military would be forced to choose sides. American democracy may never recover from this collapse of the rule of law. This column comes from Spain. Don't make the elderly use an app. Spain's older people have had it with banks that try to force them to adopt digital technology, said Irene Lozano. In many village banks, a live human is available only a few hours a day, leaving no option for customers but ATMs or smartphone apps. Now Valencia resident Carlos San Juan de Lerorden, 78, is calling for banks to provide humane treatment to the elderly by maintaining in-person services. It makes me very sad that the banks have forgotten older people like me, he said. He's not alone. My own mother was outraged when she went to the bank to withdraw cash and was patronizingly pointed to the ATM outside the door. No wonder nearly 500,000 other Spaniards, angered by digital exclusion, have signed San Juan's petition on change.org. San Juan says he's gotten calls from a top Treasury official and the governor of the Bank of Spain about his demands. We should all hope they listen, because this is a larger battle for human dignity. As rapid innovation leads to the proliferation of new technologies, we will all lose skills and find ourselves excluded. The TikTok and metaverse users of today will be the old men of tomorrow, and young people who consider themselves technologically fluent now should be thanking the elderly for warning us. Title of The Last Word, our feature article, is I Remember Just Being Scared to Death. Shefali Luthra of the 19th spoke to people around the country to find personal narratives of life before Roe v. Wade, when getting an abortion meant pursuing shadowy connections and enduring pain and extreme risk. This year marks the 49th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, the landmark ruling that guaranteed the right to an abortion. It could very well not reach a 50th anniversary before it's overturned. During oral arguments for Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization last year, a majority of the court appeared ready to overturn Roe v. Wade, allowing states to ban abortion entirely. A decision is expected this summer. Such a reversal would be historic. Prior to Roe v. Wade, people seeking abortions were forced to find clandestine clinics, borrow spare cash, and travel hundreds of miles, sometimes under cover of darkness, for risky procedures that they learned about through word of mouth. There was the lingering worry that a procedure might not work, and if it did, that it could result in medical complications or even death. Few expect the United States to revert to 1972. Many Democratic-led states are now likely to pass laws cementing abortion protections, creating oases of access to the procedure in safe, legal settings. But options would still be far more limited. To better understand the decision's impact, the 19th spoke with people across the country about their memories of life before the 1973 decision, as well as how things have changed in the years since. Below are some of their stories in their own words. Susie Scott, 73. It was spring in my sophomore year in college, 1968, and I was here in Laramie at Wyoming University. The word was in Laramie because we're quite close to the Colorado-Wyoming border. It's about 50 miles. That if you knew the right folks, you could drive to Colorado, where doctors might provide illegal abortions. I was in a relationship with a man I had essentially been with since seventh grade. I did not take the decision of what to do lightly. When it became evident that we were not going to get married, I started inquiring as to what, how, when, where. I had a sorority sister at the time who was from Colorado, and I took her aside and we had a conversation. She had just had a friend who was in Denver who was in the same situation I was. There was kind of a third party who let me know about the provider in Colorado. I called, and of course the first thing right up front was that all procedures were to be paid in cash up front. If I recall right, it was like $575. Where does a college student find an extra $575 in 1968? It was my money, the young man's money, and money from some of our friends. There were very, very few people who knew about the predicament. In those days, it was considered really risky. And so you can count on one hand the people I was telling. A friend offered to drive me to Denver, and the instructions where I was to register at the hotel, motel thing not far from the provider's office in northern Denver, register there. And after the procedure, I was to go back and spend the evening in the motel and come back and see him in the morning. I went in the back door, and I remember just being scared to death, absolutely scared to death, because I didn't know what to expect. They were going to inject me with some sort of solution that would in a few hours result in a miscarriage, if you will. So I gave the money, I had the procedure, and my friend and I went back to the motel. A few hours into the evening, nothing was happening. Nothing. And I thought, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. I've just handed this fellow $575, and maybe this whole thing is a hoax. I said to my friend, I want to go back to Laramie. I'm incredibly uncomfortable here. I'm scared to death. Let's just get back to Laramie. So we got in the car, drove back to Laramie, and about the time we got to the outskirts of town, which means it's almost sunrise, I started having contractions and went through the entire day. The following night, without having passed a fetus, I got scared and thought, what in the world? So my friend drove me to the hospital, and I spent the next 2 days in the hospital. Fortunately, it was end of the school year, so people were moving out of the sorority house. Lots of activity. Nobody really realized that I was gone for a couple of days. The physicians, or the providers, the hospital kept pressuring me to tell them what had happened. They thought I had sought an abortion. One of the providers, and he was a provider here for a long, long time, very well respected, he came to my bedside and said, Susie, if you don't pass the fetus here in the next few hours, we're going to have a surgical procedure. You know, you're there. What do you say? Luckily, I passed it. That was it. About 4 years later, I was working in Denver. I got on an elevator, and there was the doctor who had performed the abortion. I remembered his face. I just, you know, punched the next floor and got off the elevator. He was very scary. My take was that in a strange way, he got pleasure out of the fact that I was at his mercy. Lorraine Solino Klein, 72. I graduated in 1967 from high school, and I went straight into nursing. I wasn't even aware of the abortion laws in New York. I mean, you heard stories of people who were going to some back rooms or doctors. We had heard stories about that happening. Then somebody would disappear. There was a hush. She was pregnant and she'd be away. So we didn't know whether she went to an aunt to have a baby or was pushed off somewhere to have an abortion. But everything was hush-hush. We didn't talk about it at all. When I was 18, I went right to nursing school at Brooklyn, New York, Kings County Hospital Center School of Nursing. It was a 3-year diploma. We got these pink lab coats and we were supposed to talk to patients. Everybody I knew in my circle of new friends got old people. I was assigned to a 16-year-old. I walk into the room and there were like 6 or 8 doctors standing around this beautiful looking girl. I mean, I'm 18, she's 16, and her eyes are rolled back. She's thrashing all over the bed. And all these docs are totally helpless. This kid was pregnant. She went for a pill, and then she went for a coat hanger because she wasn't sure it was working. She was a Catholic kid. She didn't have anybody or anywhere to go. She didn't know where to look for help. And here are the doctors, and I'm in charge of taking temperature. The temperature was going up. It goes to 107. Oh, it was the most horrible thing I have ever seen in my life. She dies in front of all these doctors, and they're helpless to do anything to help. They wanted to. There was just nothing they could do. Rosalind Jonas, 75. The illegal abortion was in 1966. I had just turned 20. It was the first guy I slept with, and I did not know blank about birth control or any other thing. I was 19 when I got pregnant and 20 when I realized that. I was living at home and with deeply conservative parents who I simply could not tell. I had a very good friend who was at Goucher College in Towson, Maryland. It was a girls' school and they had a network, a pipeline to a gynecologist in Baltimore. So I got myself to Baltimore. The gynecologist was a lovely lady and she said, "Can you tell your parents?" And I said, "No." Then she gave me a little tiny folded piece of paper with a phone number on it and said, "Call this number." It was supposed to be $600 in cash. The day before the abortion, I was $200 short. The boy was just a real prick, so I called his parents. They gave him $600, and he gave me $200 that I was short. He did drive me to Utah Street, and I stood there waiting to be picked up. Finally, a man in a sedan with a dog in the back seat pulls up. He could have been a serial killer, but he had a dog. That's how you knew it must be okay. I got in the back seat and we drove out to Baltimore County. I don't know where, to a farmhouse. There was a couple in the farmhouse. They laid me down on the table and gave me a mask. I had no anesthesia. After a while, somebody I presume to be a doctor comes out wearing scrubs and he performs the abortion. He leaves. And the people who are there give me some pills to dry up my milk and some maxi pads. And then the guy drives me back to the movie theater on Utah Street. I stayed with a friend. I didn't go back to my parents at night. That was it. At the time, I had a job working on the Hill for a Maryland congressman, and I was absolutely crazed that I had done this. I had done this illegal thing, and was that going to come back and, you know, but nobody ever found out about it. Warren Hearn, 83. I began to get acquainted with this issue when I was a junior medical student. This is back in 1963. Every night that I was on call in the gynecology ward, my colleagues and I were up all night taking care of women who had either self-induced or poorly done illegal, unsafe abortions. I didn't really understand it, to tell you the truth. About that time, there was a woman who had gone to the emergency room to see if they could end the pregnancy. She was several months pregnant. When they refused, she went home and shot herself in the uterus and then drove to the hospital. It became clear to me that the effects of the illegal abortion and the abortion laws were visited particularly among women who were poor or many members of minority groups. The death rate due to illegal abortions was 9 times higher among black women than it was among white women. I was in Colorado in 1973 when the Roe v. Wade decision came down. There was a group in Boulder that wanted to start a private nonprofit abortion clinic, and they got my name and called me and asked if I would be willing to help them start this clinic. I had no intention of doing something like that, but when they invited me, I accepted the invitation because I thought it was an important thing to do. We started performing abortions in November 1973. I immediately became the target of hatred by not only some anti-abortion people in the public, but members of the medical community. I was subjected to a lot of abuse and a lot of obscene death threats in the middle of the night. I was living up in the mountains in a cabin I got with my father, and I was very, very frightened. I expected to be assassinated any time. Most of my patients now, or at least half of them, sometimes more, are patients who have desired pregnancies that have a terrible complication of fetal disorder, genetic disorder, and they've decided to end the pregnancy, even though it's a desired pregnancy. We see a lot of patients with those circumstances. We see patients who are extremely young, 11 and 12 years old, who've been raped or sexually abused, victims of incest. These young girls should not have to carry a pregnancy to term. It's very dangerous for them. They're not prepared to be a parent. But in any case, right now as we speak, we have anti-abortion fanatics in front of my office. There's a man that comes and stalks me every Tuesday morning, and I think he wants to kill me. I have to assume that because five of my medical colleagues have been assassinated. A version of this story was originally published by the 19th. Here's a couple of health and science pieces. Possible risk factors for long COVID. One of the mysteries of long COVID is why it affects some patients but not others. Many patients bounce back from the coronavirus with no ill effects, but some suffer months of debilitating physical, neurological, or cognitive symptoms such as brain fog and extreme fatigue. New research has identified four biological factors that can potentially help predict who might develop the condition known as post-acute sequelae of COVID-19, PASC. The study followed 209 patients for up to 3 months after their COVID diagnosis and found that these four factors were relevant even when the original infection was mild. A high viral load, the presence of autoantibodies, which are antibodies that mistakenly attack body tissues, the reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus, a common infection that usually goes dormant, and type 2 diabetes. Of the 37% of patients in the study who reported three or more of the most common symptoms of long COVID, 95% had one or more of these risk factors. The most influential seems to be autoantibodies, which appeared in two-thirds of the cases. The other three factors were each involved in one-third of the cases. There is no single test, no imaging study, that can be used to give a diagnosis on long COVID, researcher Charles Downs of the University of Miami told NBCNews.com. This helps move us in that direction. Webb telescope hits its mark. A month after launching, the James Webb Space Telescope has arrived at its final destination, reports the Washington Post, a spot beyond the moon and nearly 1 million miles from Earth. The $10 billion Space Observatory had already completed complex maneuvers to prepare for deployment, unfurling an enormous sun shield and an array of 18 gold-plated hexagonal mirrors. A final firing of the thruster eased the telescope into a sweet spot of stability known as a Lagrange point, where the gravitational forces of the sun and Earth balance the centrifugal force of orbit. We expected challenges, as every mission does, said NASA's John Durning. Nothing went wrong. Seven times more sensitive than the Hubble Space Telescope, and three times its size, the Webb will be able to see deep into the past, right back to when the first stars and galaxies started twinkling shortly after the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. The next challenge is aligning the mirrors to focus the telescope. That's a fiddly process involving tiny adjustments to individual mirror segments so that all the pieces work as one. It's expected to take about 3 months. And we'll flip right over to the Talking Points page, starting with COVID. Is it time to reclaim our normal lives? We are living in two COVID Americas, said David Leonard in the New York Times, and it's time to question whether the perpetually anxious Democrats really are following the science at this stage of the pandemic. As infections from the Omicron variant dramatically fall in much of the country, a recent morning consult poll found that 65% of Republicans want us to live as normally as possible. The same percentage of Democrats, however, said they want to prioritize health and safety over a return to normalcy. Strikingly, vaccinated Americans are about twice as likely to say they are very or somewhat concerned about getting COVID, despite studies showing that for those who had booster shots, the virus is about as dangerous as a normal flu. Many progressives, it seems, are stuck in safety mode and are willing to continue pandemic isolation and disruption despite the widespread mental health problems it has caused, especially in children. Our risk calculations should have fundamentally shifted once vaccines became widely available, said Matthew Iglesias in his Substack newsletter. With vaccination rendering COVID a manageable disease, quality of life should carry more weight than minimizing infections. The Biden administration should adopt a new message. Get your shots and live your life. Not everyone playing it safe is worried about their personal demise, said Melody Schreiber in the New Republic. People who still wear masks indoors and shun restaurants and crowds may be trying to avoid infecting unvaccinated kids, elderly parents, or grandparents, or loved ones who are immunocompromised. They may be justifiably worried that even mild cases can lead to the still mysterious long COVID, or that getting infected will cause them to miss work and isolate them from friends and family. To everyone shouting about wanting their normal lives back, said David Wallace Wells in New York Magazine, what's stopping you? No state has imposed a lockdown in 18 months. Most companies have reopened offices for those who want to come in, and there is no one anywhere in the country proposing that schools close down in an indefinite and preemptive way. Restaurants and bars are open, and concerts and sports events are at full capacity. In blue states, you may need to show proof of vaccination in some venues, and you might get dirty looks if you stroll through the supermarket without a mask. But come on, how intrusive is all that? Endless anxiety certainly isn't helping kids, said Eric Bohm in Reason. Los Angeles recently required students at public schools to wear non-cloth masks at all times, including while playing sports, despite evidence that severe cases of COVID are extremely rare among kids. For boosted adults, you're roughly 50 times less likely to end up hospitalized with COVID than someone who has not received a single dose. That should convince people to end their pandemic paranoia. In a new Monmouth poll, 70% of Americans say we just need to get on with our lives, said Rich Lowry in the National Review. President Biden and other Democratic leaders no doubt want to encourage a return to normalcy, but to do so, they'll have to endure the scolding of public health experts and cries of betrayal from the risk-averse progressive base. The public health experts agree we should lift restrictions now, said Dr. Lena Nguyen in the Washington Post. Since the spread of Omicron is likely to be under control nationwide by the end of February, we should have enough population immunity from vaccination and recent infection to experience a lull in the coming months. Let's appreciate this period of relative calm while we can, dropping mandatory masking while continuing to impose vaccine requirements at businesses and other public places. Some people argue that we should keep all precautions in place because dangerous variants are likely to follow Omicron. But it is precisely because of this future threat that we need to allow normalcy now. We all desperately need a break. People were also weary of making sacrifices in 1920 after 2 years of battling the Spanish flu pandemic, said John Barry in the New York Times. Most Americans by then had natural immunity to the respiratory contagion, but a new lethal variant emerged in the third year of the pandemic that should have caused cities to reimpose restrictions on public gatherings. Instead, most people ignored this fourth wave, which ended up causing the majority of the pandemic deaths in the U.S. We should not repeat this mistake. Eventually, the vaccination of billions of people globally and the widespread availability of antiviral drugs should bring a close to the COVID emergency. Right now, though, the virus may not be finished with us, no matter how badly we want to be finished with it. Affirmative action, are its days numbered? It looks like it's game over for affirmative action, said Paul Butler in the Washington Post. The Supreme Court announced last week that it will review two cases challenging the use of race as a factor in college admission decisions, specifically at Harvard and the University of North Carolina. Chief Justice John Roberts and his five conservative colleagues have made it clear they see affirmative action as discriminatory. But policies helping underrepresented minorities secure places at top schools have been among the most successful racial justice interventions of the past 50 years. I got into Yale University and then Harvard Law School because of affirmative action, and because of those opportunities, I am now a law professor at Georgetown University. Banning affirmative action would be disastrous for blacks and Hispanics, said Erwin Kamerinsky in the Los Angeles Times. When California outlawed affirmative action in 1996, admission rates for minorities at UCLA plummeted from 52% to 24% in 1998. There are many thorny legal questions within modern American life, said Charles C.W. Cook in the National Review. Affirmative action is not among them. The 1964 Civil Rights Act flatly states no person should face discrimination because of race. In 2003, the Supreme Court ruled that racial bias was temporarily justified to produce more diverse student bodies, a nonsensical precedent that should be overturned. People don't realize how discriminatory these policies have become, said Richard Sander in the New York Daily News. A typical out-of-state applicant at UNC has a 25% chance of admission if he or she is Asian American, and 99% if he or she is black. That creates a big academic gulf between students of different races, and research has shown that the less qualified are more likely to struggle academically and socially and drop out. Affirmative action can continue to have value if it's based on economic disadvantage, not race or gender, said John McWhorter in the New York Times. When affirmative action began in the 1960s, more than half of black Americans were poor. The black middle class was tiny, and the idea of a black president seemed like a folly. Today, should Barack Obama's daughters or my middle class biracial kids get extra points for their skin color? Affirmative action undoubtedly helped the black middle class grow. Let's now extend its benefits to disadvantaged people of all races or ethnicities. And here's a few shorter notes. Dark money groups backing Democrats spent about 60% more money during the 2020 presidential election than those allied with Republicans. Tax filings and other data indicate that 15 nonprofit groups with undisclosed donors that align with the Democratic Party spent more than $1.5 billion versus $900 million by 15 comparable GOP-aligned groups. A 50-year-old bridge that collapsed in Pittsburgh last week just before President Biden visited the city to tout his infrastructure plan is one of more than 46,000 in the U.S. that have been rated in poor condition, according to a report last year from the American Society of Civil Engineers. Washington state trooper who quit rather than comply with a vaccine mandate, telling Governor Jay Inslee to kiss my ass, has died of COVID. Robert LeMay, 50, was hailed on Fox News for his anti-vaccine stance, with host Laura Ingraham saying he had awakened a sleeping giant. LeMay leaves a wife and four children. On the poll watch, 48% of U.S. voters think President Biden should keep his promise to nominate the first black woman to the Supreme Court, including 92% of black voters and 50% of women voters. 31% said they did not think Biden should keep his promise, but instead should consider all qualified candidates. And we'll finish the program today with a quote from author James Baldwin, quoted in the New York Times, who says, "You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read, as we do." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.